This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Horcruxes and Heartbreak, of Books, Souls, and Killing Your Darlings.
So this episode was actually prompted by one of our listeners who was picking up on a previous episode and made the observation that every time an author writes something, they're basically creating a Horcrux. And we really liked that idea, so we thought we'd do an episode on it.
Yeah. A shout out to Matt Willis, who said, "Books are authors' Horcruxes, discuss." Are we disgusting? I don't think we've quite got there yet.
Well,
give us time. For those people who, for some reason, haven't read Harry Potter and don't know what a Horcrux is, a Horcrux is a black magical device or a dark magical device whereby you kill somebody and it will store part of your soul in this device, having transformed it into a Horcrux, and therefore even if your body is destroyed, you will not make that final trip into death. So you will not fully die. You will have the ability to come back, or the potential to.
And thus, that is how Voldemort, that's how it's meant to be pronounced. Did you know that? That's how Voldemort survived so continuously in the series, despite being vanquished repeatedly. So again, that's for anyone who hasn't read Harry Potter, spoiler, Voldemort has separated his soul into a bunch of Horcruxes. With that in mind, and within the lore of the Harry Potter universe, I think it was actually Stephen King made a point when he said that J.K. Rowling had actually created a bunch of Horcruxes when she wrote seven books. She'd written seven books. Seven is the number of Horcruxes that Voldemort has. And everyone said, yeah, J.K. Rowling now also has seven Horcruxes through which she will live forever because of her fame. And then someone turned around and said, yeah, but doesn't that mean if the books are her Horcruxes, doesn't that mean she's had to have killed somebody? To which someone else responded, yeah, sure she has, and proceeded to list all of the secondary characters that J.K. Rowling butchered. Yeah. So thanks for breaking my heart again.
And it does rather leave you with the question of exactly how many Horcruxes does George R.R. Martin now have?
He's going to live eternally.
It's like, it would be impossible to take him down. It's like the White Walkers would be nothing to trying to kill George R.R. Martin now, because, I don't know, there are Horcruxes everywhere. He's killed so many people. And there will be more deaths. We know there will be more deaths.
We know there will be more deaths.
He actually said himself, "I don't know why everyone's looking forward to the winds of winter. It's only going to upset you all."
So, yeah, Voldemort would probably bow down to George R.R. Martin. He is king of the Horcruxes. Of course, this is not a new trend, the massacring of characters. And that's also part of what our episode is going to be discussing today. It's going to be discussing how we insert ourselves, writing as a piece of our soul, and how then we are capable of murdering the characters that we nurtured. And then the question of whether murdering a character or killing a character actually ultimately makes the book more memorable in the sense that it will make it last and live longer.
Probably a good starting point is the fact that, as you said, books tend to be a part of an author's soul, at least if the author is writing with any kind of emotional honesty, which is something I've really touted as being a big thing before. Because it doesn't matter what genre you're writing in. And, you know, in a way, it often doesn't matter whether you personally, as a reader, like that genre. If the writer is writing with emotional honesty, you can usually appreciate the book, even if you don't like it, because it's not your sort of thing.
Yeah.
So that's important. But in order to get that emotional honesty in the first place, the author is sacrificing quite a lot. Writing's fun. And it can be a joyful experience as well. But it's really, really hard, and it's quite painful too.
I think one of the most frustrating things, I mean, we could do an entire episode about things not to say to an author.
Yeah.
maybe that's our next one.
Yeah.
But one of the things that a lot of authors and a lot of writers because I'm not just going to say authors, you know, comic book writer, script writers, a lot of people here is, I'm going to write a book when I have time. And that annoys a lot of people because, A, whilst I am a fervent believer that everybody has a story to tell within them, I am also very practical in thinking that not everyone has the capability to tell that story, at least not to the degree that some of them think that they can. And that's because writing, in a certain sense, there are some people who are born to be writers, but no one just comes out with that kind of raw talent. Writing is incredibly hard, and the commitment it requires to write means that when you turn around and say, oh, well, I'm just waiting till I have some time before I start writing my book, you're never going to have time to write a book. You literally never, ever, ever, no matter whether you're retired, you never have time to write a book. Writing a book is a sacrifice of a large section of your life. And so when you consider how much of yourself is already going into that alone, just for the time and the energy that you have to put into creating it, that alone makes a book special. And then, of course, we've got the whole other dimension of the emotional side, which is what Jules is, you know, talking about. Jules is talking about the insertion of an emotional honesty that a lot of people don't actually feel comfortable with and don't actually have the capability to express in the day-to-day. And when you touch down on that, that's when you create something really special.
It's the emotional honesty side of it is a case of, if you cannot even be partially emotionally honest with yourself, and this is about your worst aspects and the worst things you've done, the most embarrassing things you've done or that have happened to you, or the most horrible and heartbreaking things that have happened to you, as well as the really good things as well, learning to really appreciate the good sides of your life. Yeah. If you can't be honest about all of that to yourself, then it won't come out in your writing, which is partly why writing is so painful, because you're going through a lot of all this sort of stuff in order to get it out. You don't have to be writing a memoir or anything like that. You're certainly not writing yourself warts and all.
No, but
creating that emotional honesty that resonates with people, even though they don't know that's what's ticking the boxes for them, is really difficult if you cannot be honest with yourself.
Yeah.
So, you know, there you go, writing. It's like your own personal AA meeting.
Funny, because it's like your own personal AA meeting whilst you're also doing the thing that you're addicted to.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the final irony of writing for you.
As well as that, we also plan on talking a little bit about reviews and how they affect writers. But first, let's talk a little bit more about putting your soul into writing. Now, in a previous episode, I mentioned Roland Barthes' Death of the Author, and we talked about fan fiction. You know, there are a lot of different opinions about ownership of things, and you know, we mentioned the fact that once you publish something, once you put a piece of writing out into the public domain, people get to start having a little bit of ownership of it, which is out of your control. People will take hold of it, people will do with things with it that you didn't necessarily intend them to do. And in that respect, you do lose ownership. The author dies a little bit when they release their work, because from that point on, someone else will pick up that work and they will interpret it through their own experience and their own life, and no two people will ever read the same book. So yeah, what they're reading isn't going to be the same thing that you wrote, if that makes sense. Now, when you insert a lot of yourself and when you write with emotional honesty, that will tend to really resonate well with people, because they will resonate with the characters. It will feel close to them in the same way that it felt close to you, because people, even if we come from very different walks of life, we often have we have the same emotions, you know, we have the same number of emotions, we have the same kind of brains, and yeah, we react differently to things, but ultimately we recognize these things, even if we haven't experienced them in the same way. I've lost where I was going with this.
Well, no, I think you're right, actually, because that's the powerful thing about writing. You can have a completely different mindset. You can come from a completely different culture with different mores, different values, a different background, and you can read something that is so opposite to everything you know. And yet, a writer who writes with emotional honesty about their story can make you see things from another perspective.
Yeah.
So that's what's so powerful about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it's not an easy thing to do, as we've previously discussed. And I'm not saying that, you know, a book that doesn't totally touch your soul isn't therefore worth reading, because that's nonsense. You know, books are a form of entertainment, and for some people, that's all they want. We're talking, and we're not just basing this on literary fiction. We're talking about a book being good because it has a real characters. For me, is the biggest thing. We seem to slag it off every episode, but let's talk a little bit about, you know, compare 50 Shades of Grey, right? 50 Shades of Grey, commercial fiction, not literary, obviously. The characters have as much substance as, you know, a sponge. Well, no, sponges absorb things. These characters absorb nothing. It's just a wooden spoon. The character of a wooden spoon.
They're kind of like Rivita, you know, without anything on.
Yeah, it's a very good description. You know, there is no emotional honesty at all in what's being written there. There isn't. And that means that you are following the actions, but you're not really following the characters, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's easy to read, but, you know, you put it down and you go, whew, well, maybe I'm a bit flushed because of that disgusting sex scene, but, or not, I guess. Depends what you're into.
Depends whether he rolled up his socks efficiently beforehand.
Ah.
Unquote. Seriously, who rolls up their socks efficiently?
Well, I'll have you know, Jules, that I'm very efficient at rolling up.
Before?
Oh dear. Yeah, of course.
Well, clearly I'm just a Philistine then, aren't I?
But we compare that, and I'm going to pick up, we've talked about Harry Potter, let's talk about Harry Potter. We compare that with Harry Potter, right? That's a children's book. I would dare it's not literary fiction. I don't think we can call it literary fiction. Would you?
I don't know. Literary fiction is one of those titles whereby no one really knows what it is until they see it. It's not literary fiction, but it is definitely the finer kind of children's fiction. Mind you, most children's fiction is the finer kind of children's fiction, otherwise it doesn't get published.
Yeah, because they're quite picky. So yeah, you look at Harry Potter, and that's written with an incredible amount of emotional honesty. And you know that, and you can feel it, and you fall in love with the characters, and that's why it works so well. So that's what we mean when we say writing, you know, with feeling, is that Harry Potter is not the, you know, the memoir tale of a boy who's struggling to, you know, survive the abuse that he suffered, and it's not meant to tear our hearts in that way. It's the story about a boy in a magical world, and that is the focus. And yet, he still tears our hearts out because we feel sorry for these very poor characters who suffer a great deal. And yeah, so we're not saying go out, you can only write literary fiction. We're saying that no matter what the project is, a book will only ever be improved by having that kind of honesty in it.
Yeah. And I think one of the big clues that something has been written with real emotional honesty is how much you get attached to the secondary and tertiary characters.
Yeah.
You know, you have your tier one characters. In Harry Potter, it would be Hermione, Harry, and Ron, easily. And then your second tier characters would be people like Snape and McGonagall and Dumbledore, Lupin, the adults who really don't, you know, get that involved with what happened, and some of the other children as well. Yeah. And then you have your tier three characters, and obviously in a big series of seven books, characters can move up and down the tiers a lot. But just for the sake of argument, say it's something like that. But we get attached to characters like Hagrid and Dumbledore and Snape. Snape, oddly enough, because we are designed to hate Snape to start with. If you didn't feel anything for Snape at the end of, say, you know, the Half-Blood Prince and, you know, the Deathly Hallows, there's something wrong with you.
Because he was do an entire episode about Snape.
Okay.
And how I feel about him. I obviously felt sorry for him, but at the same time, I've never forgiven him because, yeah, it was heartbreaking. But you know, he still made those children's lives a living nightmare, and that's not really excusable.
He was largely a despicable person, but ultimately, he was good. And there was a lot more to it. I don't know. As you say, we could do an entire episode on Snape.
We could do an entire episode.
But the fact that we're going off on a tangent shows how well that book was written with emotional honesty, because you can get that attached to a secondary character. There is so much that could be hung on just a secondary character.
And I think another obvious sign that it's not just that you can get attached to a secondary character, it's that you can have discussions about them.
Yeah.
You know? That's when you go, okay, hold on a second. If you can actually end up discussing these things, then you know that you kind of hit a jackpot. If there is discussion about characters and people interpret them differently, it tends to mean that these characters have substance enough that they can be interpreted in these different ways. Again, in a previous episode, we also talked about inserting yourself into stories, which I think also does happen, and especially if you are writing with that kind of honesty, you will create characters who are based on you, which is why when you get bad reviews, it hurts like hell.
I think
so. Let's talk about that.
That's part of it, and actually just creating something that's been so close to you for such a long period of time that you've like lived and breathed it and, you know, dreamed it and slept it kind of thing. Perhaps instead of going straight to reviews, let's start with critique, because critique is something that every author should learn how to both give and receive, partly because you learn more by giving critique than you do by receiving it, and also because it's a really good idea to have yourself sort of pretty well ballast against critique that you don't agree with or don't like early on, so that you can behave appropriately. I've seen, I'm part of a writer's forum, I've seen a lot of people really, really throw their toys out of the pram and throw prima donna hissy fits over some, and it can be literally a single line of critique that was quite politely said, but perhaps a tiny bit blunter than they wanted, or, you know, we didn't see the grand vision they thought they were communicating. And rather than be wrong, and rather than do the really hard, painful task of looking at it from a distant perspective and saying, was I being honest there? Could I have written it in a better way? Or did I shy away from it because it was going to hurt? Or, you know, have I just been a bit lazy, perhaps? Because no one likes that, but sometimes we all do something a little bit lazy when we're writing. Instead of doing any of that, no, the person critiquing is wrong. And there are ways to respond to that. But one of them, in fact, the way you should never, ever respond, particularly if you're going online and having online critiques, as so many of them are, is to write a hasty, angry response, perhaps incorporating a few choice expletives, and basically tell them that they know nothing and that they cannot see your genius, etc., etc., and storm off in a huff. And I have to say that in my experience, it tends to be male writers who do this more often. So for every female writer I've seen who's done this, I have seen at least 10 or 11 male authors, and that's no exaggeration. Now, perhaps that's because I've got no reason for that. Is it because women are less likely to come forward and say, oh, you've hurt my feelings? Or is it men are more likely to see something as an attack and come back a bit aggressively and then say, oh, sorry, I actually didn't mean that. Who knows?
Yeah, there's all sorts of reasons. And of course, we're not saying that women are not capable, totally capable.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, yeah. In fact, actually, I tend to find that when women do come back from that kind of thing, they tend to come back even harder.
Yeah, this is true. But basically, there are three things you need to remember when someone's giving you critique. And one is ultimately, yes, they might pick up on issues with your writing that you need to address, but they're in the end, they're not the author of the story. Perhaps they just don't get it. That's okay. Perhaps they've got a point, but they can't really show you how to fix it. Quite often, people can show you what's wrong, but they can rarely show you how to fix it. Perhaps, it's not personal and they are actually trying to help you. You can tell the people who are just feeding you a line of bullshit because what they say in their critique doesn't make any sense ultimately, and it'll be filled with passive aggressive words and phrases and I'm really sorry, I'm sure you were trying to do this and that sort of phrasing, and they're not trying to help you, they're just wasting your time. So ignore those people. But you should always respond with accept, adapt, or reject. Those are your three things with critique.
And I think authors, writers who start out are afraid of critique, and they're especially afraid of critique from other authors, I think.
Oh, I still am.
it just makes me it takes me back when I, when I was just really starting out as a writer, and my brother wanted to introduce me to somebody, and he said, "Oh, you'll love this person. You'll love this guy. He's a writer." And instantly, I went, "I do not want to meet this person." And he's there like, "But why? You have so much to talk about." And I'm like, "In general, writers do not want to actually meet other writers. I mean, they can do it on a professional scale. They go, okay, I'm going to go onto a writers forum and get in touch with other writers. But on a social scale, if you try and introduce two people and say, you should be friends. Look, you're both writers. It doesn't, I've never really seen it work really to start with, because unless you cannot base a friendship on the fact that you're both writers, because if you try and come from that angle, you come into it, you look at that person and you just see competition. And then, it's an ugly thing, but you know what? It's real. And I'm not afraid to admit that, at that time when I was still trying to really find my own worth, and when I was trying to, figure out where I stood and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When someone said, "Yeah, look, this person's a writer," I thought, I'm sure they are. And I didn't really, really want to know about it, because I was afraid that they would be significantly better than me.
It's like two
And
cats fighting over the same patch of sunlight, or Highlander, there can only be one. And obviously, all authors carry around swords just in case they need to chop another writer's head off.
Of course. but yeah, I was terrified. I was terrified of meeting somebody who was better at what I loved doing than me, especially on a social level like that, which is not the correct way to come forward to it. And when I started at university, we had to start doing workshopping, and a big part of that was critiquing. And now that I'm teaching, I compare what it's like for the first years who we get to workshop with what it's like for the third years. And you notice two things. First of all, they speak a lot less, and their critique is often overly polite, to the point where they don't actually say anything useful, because A, I think they're afraid of offending, and B, I think they're afraid that if they critique somebody, someone is going to turn around and critique them. And they don't actually really want to be critiqued, because up until that point, being critiqued was not a positive thing. It was a negative thing. It meant that they had failed. And one of the most important lessons you can learn as a writer is that the first draft is perfect. The only thing the first draft needs to be in order to be perfect is finished, and editing and the whole thing that follows after that, that's what makes a great book. It's not actually the first time it's written. So critique is actually incredible. If someone finds the time to give you good critique, that is the most valuable thing that you can have. But until you come to that conclusion, and you really have to come to it yourself, you're going to be afraid of critiques. And in the same way that you'd be afraid of reviews. And as Jules has stated very clearly, negative reviews and negative critique are not the same thing.
Critique is intended to improve your work, to help you. That's not to say, as I mentioned, that there are time wasters. It's also worth looking at how you critique somebody. When I first started out critiquing, there was one piece I went into, and I mean, I did very many years ago, obviously. I did an English A level, which, you know, was really easy for me, just because it was really easy for me. So I already had sort of analytical skills I needed, and I just went straight in the spirit of genuine helpfulness, and tore something apart completely, saying, well, you should write it like this and like that. And it was completely the wrong thing to do. And I realised it with hindsight, which, you know, is wonderful. And I haven't done it again since. And there are other people who've done the same thing to me. So, I mean, in fairness, looking at it, the first time someone comes in and critiques you like a bull in a china shop, just take a deep breath, walk away, get the anger out of your system, then look at what they've said and see if there was anything valuable at all. Because the chances are they were trying to help. It's just they have no idea of how to do it in a socially acceptable way without obviously not saying anything at all.
We're not saying that critique doesn't hurt, because it's like having a plaster ripped off. It can really hurt, even if it's done gently, even if it's done with the best intention, even if it's done by someone you know, someone you've asked for a critique. If they turn around and say, okay, this, it is like a blow to the chest, because in some respects you wanted them to turn around and say, no, it's perfect.
Yeah.
If it isn't perfect, it means even more work for you, and it means that you have to reevaluate, and you also have to look at yourself and be honest about whether you've been lazy or not, which is something we discussed. And it's really hard to admit if you've been lazy, but yeah. We do all get lazy, so.
That being said, beware of authors who ask you for critique when what they really want is a pat on the head. Because there are some out there, and they tend to be people who like to write, but they probably won't go any further, because in order to go further, you have to go through the painful growing process, and you go through the painful growing process by being critiqued and improving your writing. So yeah. I would suggest that once you've discovered a few people like that, if they ask you for critique, you just say that you don't really feel you can, unless you want to, unless you're happy just reading something and patting someone on the head. Obviously, I mean, it's far, far be it for me to say, but personally, I think it's a bit of a waste of time.
I again, something I tend to find with the workshop is that if we go back to the third years and how they workshop stuff, if they're all being really polite to something, it tends to mean it's not very good.
Yeah.
And it tends to mean, look, we don't have the energy to be able to, we don't have enough time to tell you what is wrong with this. You know, unless someone very brave steps up and goes, look, it's this, 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 and this. They don't. And actually, I tend to find that the pieces, again, in third year that get the most sort of critique are the ones which are going to come out with a first. So lots of critique isn't necessarily a bad thing.
No, absolutely. And it's writing isn't a thing whereby you reach a level and that's it. You've got to the top. You never ever stop improving. So you never stop needing critique. So I'm really sorry if I'm breaking anyone's hearts over this, but you know, this isn't something that's over. This is an ongoing process that will continue for as long as you write. So, you know, buckle yourself in and get used to it.
You're in it for the long haul, folks.
I mean, the difference, obviously, between... Sorry, did you want to say something?
No, I was going to say, let's talk about reviews. So
I was going exactly like... the same place, which was... different to critique, reviews. Reviews aren't actually really for the author at all. And generally, the received advice is don't read reviews on your books. But we do. We do. Certainly for the first couple of books, we will do, because it's impossible to resist.
We're weak.
We're weak. We crave approval. I don't know. I think there's some dark part of us that actually craves repudiation as well, possibly. So let's talk about reviews. Good reviews, bad reviews, indifferent reviews, and just plain confusing reviews.
There is nothing quite like reading a review from somebody that you don't know. Because you'll have, you know, your friends and stuff, they will review the book on Goodreads or wherever, you know, they'll review it and you'll go, yeah, okay. And then you quickly don't become satisfied with that because you know them. You know them and you start to suspect, I wonder if they're actually being honest or whether they're just saying that because they know me and they know that if they're mean, I can come and beat them with a stick. which is a genuine concern for me because I often beat people with sticks. I don't, disclaimer, I do not. I do not often beat people with sticks. That's not one of my daily pastimes.
I think there's also the case of they know you, so you're worried that they might subconsciously be looking at the book with a slightly kinder eye as well.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And, you know, I think there is always going to be an element of that. So when you pick up a review from somebody who you've never had any real interaction with, that's when you kind of hit your first real jackpot because it feels incredible. Especially, you know, if it's a good review and someone has felt connected to your book, then they've felt connected to you. And you something through this mediator, really. And it's just wonderful. And you can just grin for hours. And then you get a bad review. And the good review will set you in a good mood for the next couple of hours. The bad review will set you in a bad mood for days. It always hurts more. Yeah. So, Jules, any experiences with bad reviews?
Not yet on the book front. On a short story I wrote, I had somebody completely tear it apart. Bear in mind, it was written as sort of sci-fi light, so... Mm-hmm. It wasn't written to be like real, and it was written to be a short story, so I couldn't go over a sort of 2,500 words. The things they were picking apart in it were kind of things that I would have needed to add about 6,000 words to explain if I changed. So I'd use shorthand. So even though a day was theoretically a day is the amount of time it takes for the Earth to do one full rotation.
Yeah.
But say on this planet, a day lasted our equivalent of 14 years.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was an issue. But the thing was, using shorthand by just calling it a day made it a more accessible read for the reader. So it was done quite deliberately. The person who read it and tore it apart just did not seem to get that this was shorthand, which is fair enough. And really seemed to take exception to the fact that I hadn't made it very sciencey on purpose.
How dare you?
I was actually really quite peeved over that. And then the whole thing was, don't respond. Well, don't ever respond while you're angry, while you're annoyed, or while you're feeling hacked off. So I didn't respond about it, and until I just felt sort of level and thought, well, you know, that's just someone's opinion. Ultimately, I'm not going to change it greatly. And if they don't like it, it's sort of tough. On the book front, I think the one that bothered... No, there were two reviews that bothered me, and one of them was a 5-star review.
Jules.
No, it was lovely. It was from a complete stranger who'd written me this lovely, glowing review. I'll go into that one in a moment. The one that confused me is someone left me a 3-star review. 3 stars, you know, as far as I'm concerned, that's a good review. If I leave someone 3 stars, that's a good book. You know, I might well follow, pick up the sequel on that. It just, you know, it hasn't made my top list of books ever, but, you know, I enjoyed the book. It was good. But it was, all they put was writing pace too slow. And I was like, okay, well, that's fine. But how? In what way? I just wanted more information.
Be more constructive.
Which, you know, is absolutely not the reader's responsibility to provide for the author. I mean, it's nice when they do, but it's not their responsibility. I wouldn't say that pollacks me or anything. It was just a kind of sort of, oh, I wish you did a little bit more so I can fix it. The 5-star review, somebody read my book in concert with Wuthering Heights, read them side by side. And what really bothered me was they gave me 5 stars and they gave Emily Bronte 3 stars. And said that they didn't like Emily Bronte's book and that they found the characters unbelievable and didn't like the story. There was basically no one likeable in the entire book and it was just rubbish. and gave me a glowing review, mentioning that they'd read Wuthering Heights along the side and they felt my book was superior. Now, I have to say, that messed me up for weeks, because we have an acknowledged English classic that is part of the English canon that is some people's favourite book, even if they make the mistake of thinking it's a fabulous romance. And someone was saying, oh, no, 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 your book's better. Now, thank you very much, whoever left me with that review. You basically, like, deprived me of about 3 weeks' sleep. But I really appreciate you taking the time to leave the review. But that really messed with my head.
Jules, Jules. I have to admit something.
Yeah.
I also find I belong to the Earth Superior than Wuthering Heights. But then I really don't like Wuthering Heights.
Yeah, you see, I know that you really don't like Wuthering Heights, and it's a case of you didn't read it side along with my book, doing a comparison at the same time.
Now there's an idea, I might do that now, just to peeve you off.
I think ultimately that says a lot more about me than it does about my book, the reviewer, yeah, the reader, anything like that. That's a case of me saying, no, there are levels here, and I've not reached that level, don't put me up there, kind of thing.
I've got to come down. Yeah. Well, if that's the worst experience you've got with reviews, Jules, then I've got to admit I'm a little bit envious. I'm terrible when it comes to bad reviews. They always really hit me quite hard. And less so now. I've sort of hardened a little bit to it. But I think it's probably because the books that I released so far, and to be honest, probably the books that I'm going to continue releasing, because I'm just that kind of writer, I really do pour a lot of myself into them. And so when people, I don't expect everyone to enjoy it. I really don't. You know, I had some good family friends who turned around and said, look, we really didn't like your book. We just couldn't get into it. Yeah. And I thought, to be honest, I didn't actually expect you to, because it's really not your style. It's really not the kind of thing that you would be reading if you didn't know me. So it's not that I have an expectation for everyone to fall madly in love with it. But some people, when they write reviews, I think they do it and they have really forgotten there is an author. I think that they have become so detached from the writer itself. They only see the material, that they write things that I wonder if we were face to face, would they say that to my face? And I don't think a lot of them would. I think a lot of them, if I turn around and said, okay, why, they would actually backtrack a little bit. And it's a product of, well, actually, it's not a product of the internet. People have been writing bad reviews for a very long time. But the anonymity of the internet does make it a little bit easier. And that means that people have been quite unkind, and we're obviously discouraged from replying. Authors are discouraged from replying to negative reviews. So we don't. Sometimes I do. If it's a, you know, if they've made a question or said something like that, I'll reply saying thank you for this, with more information, or if they've left a question. But for the, yeah, you shouldn't really touch negative reviews, especially, as Jules said, when you are angry. But yeah, it hurts like hell. It really, really hurts like hell. That's my sob story.
But that's the thing. It's like the saying that it is not your business what anybody else thinks of you. And it's not your business as an author what anyone thinks of your book, ultimately. I mean, if you're constantly getting just really bad reviews and you're not getting any good reviews, it can mean one of two things. It can mean that you are just not connecting with your readers, the people who should be reading your book for some reason, which means you need to address your marketing, or it can mean that you really, really need to look at your writing. The third distinct and distant possibility is that you are writing in a way that means that you will not be appreciated in your time, but after you're dead, this will be a classic and will be taught in schools everywhere. Which is no comfort to you now while you're alive. So you might want to be a little bit more commercial now. But up to you. It might be a case if you just keep churning out books. You don't care if you get one-star reviews, that's fine. But the idea of reviews is obviously they help readers. And even a one-star review on one of your books can help you sell a book. because
yep.
a one-star review for someone might say, for someone else reading it, will say, well, actually, that sounds like all the stuff I really like in a book. So there's a positive there as well. Don't necessarily think, and it adds authenticity.
Yeah.
If there's nothing but five-star reviews, then
yeah.
you start
you go,
to
hold
wonder.
On a second. You get suspicious, especially if it's an indie book.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's only about sort of 100 reviews or so. If they're all very, very high, you do start to go, okay, hold on a second. How believable is this? And you don't want that. You don't want people to not pick up the book because they don't trust the validity of the reviews. So actually having a few negative reviews can ultimately help. So don't worry too much about that. But don't read them. Don't read the negative reviews.
there does have to be a point where you just walk away. I have a friend who got hundreds of reviews on a book, and it was just a bit of a blindsided runaway hit in that sort of area. It was a horror, sort of Lovecraftian type thing. Mm. And she said some of the five-star reviews hurt as much, if not more, than the one-star ones. So it's a case of you have to just learn to walk away from it. It's like, you don't need universal approval. You don't need everybody to care. You don't need everybody to like your work.
No. But it's nice if they do.
They're
not going to, so.
It's nice if they do, unless you're me, in which case that means that you then start to wonder what's wrong. Because that's the sort of thing you would obsess over. Moving on from... I have a very convoluted set of insecurities. I'm not very insecure about very much, but I seem to make them for myself. Out of positives. Moving on, before you even get to the review stage, of course, you will be rejected a lot if you're going through a traditional publisher.
Yes. And here's the thing. Self-publishing is great, and it's something that both Jules and I, you know, are doing. So I'm not going to knock it because I think it is good. But there is a problem with self-publishing in that if you haven't had a sort of formal education to do with writing, or you haven't tried the traditional publishing side, you probably haven't learned how to deal with rejection. And actually, why rejection is good. Because having a book rejected really actually will first of all, it'll weedle out who's really got the guts to be able to get out there and make a success of themselves. But it'll also help you analyze your book in a colder fashion. And yeah, the skills that you get from constantly being hit by rejections are not to be sneered at and are not to be looked down at, however much the process hurts.
Sometimes you'll get a rejection and some feedback, which is lovely, which means that, you know, they rejected your book probably not on the grounds of the book's content. It just wasn't really for them, be it an agent or a publisher. And then there are rejections where you get a form rejection. And then there was one very interesting, I say very interesting, not terribly interesting, but it almost defied the time-space continuum, whereby I sent a book out and that evening I had the rejection form letter on my laptop. And it was like,
wow,
there was barely time for the book to arrive. It's like you knew it was coming and you sent the form rejection before it arrived. which is hilarious when you think about it. And I think you do have to develop a bit of a sense of humour about it. But it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Save up those rejections where they've given you a personal note, because they're gold dust. They've taken time to write something, even if it's two or three lines. And it's professionals in the industry. And what I did when I was collecting my rejections was any of those sort of form notes I took on board. If I, you know, I subjected them to the same accept, adapt and reject treatment that I would for critique. Because these are professionals who know what they're looking for and know what will sell. So the book got rewritten again a couple of times in between going out for second and third rounds. And you will get rejected because no one knows you're going to sell. And they want you because you're going to sell.
Yeah.
Which
if you are one of the fortunate people who sends out their book and gets accepted the first time, first of all, really, really have a look at the publisher. Second of all, You're amazing, so well done to you.
Yeah, absolutely well done.
You sent it out when the stars were just aligned right. So there is another thing about the whole publishing side of it, which is that after several rejections, you can start to feel a little bit desperate. And that doesn't mean that you should accept the first offer that is laid on the table.
That's where I was going next as well, actually. I was going to say, yes, accept that your book's probably not perfect and critique is valuable. Accept rejections and that they're not personal. That's where you step away from your work and admit that your work is not you. It's not you being rejected. It's just that it's not for them. But also, know your own worth. Don't think just because somebody has made an offer to you that you have to accept it. Really look at it. Really look at the offer, because there are some wonderful indie publishing houses out there who produce really great work and have wonderful distribution systems and look after their authors. I can think of half a dozen off the top of my head. And there are indie publishers out there that are perhaps a little less savoury. Now, I don't mean vanity outfits. Basically, if anybody says, yes, we'd love to publish your book for this princely sum or of £2,000 or whatever, they're a vanity outfit. Money never goes from the author to the publisher. It's always the other way around. Always. So don't believe that. But they're not a real publisher at all. Ignore them. Have nothing to do with them. Looking at publishing contracts, there are red flags on things. And the first time you receive a publishing contract, it is one of the scariest documents you can imagine, probably, if you're a writer and you care about your work. And it'll have things in it that you probably should avoid. I don't think we can really go into it too much here because we just don't have the scope, but perhaps I'll blog about it and you can look in there. But there are things like, do not sign a clause that says that you promise your next book to that publisher without really, really examining it, for example, because you don't want to find yourself in indentured servitude to one publisher. And also,
unless you do.
But, you know, I would suggest you try them out and see how you go. I would also say, don't sign away all your rights. They're not going to see how well a publisher can exploit your rights. So film rights, theatre, dramatic rights, radio rights, and audiobook, forum rights. See how well they're exploiting them for other authors that they've got on their books. Because if they haven't got the ability to exploit them, why do they want them?
The most important thing to remember when you've received a contract, whether it's a good contract, whether it's a bad contract, is to go to the web, because there are huge communities of writers out there. Someone else will be talking about the publisher that you are looking at. And if you can't find any writing on the publisher on the web, maybe avoid them. And as scary as the document is, there are people out there who will help you decipher it. And all you need to do is get in touch. So really make use of these writerly communities, because that whole thing that we talked about at the start, where you feel threatened by writers, do not feel threatened by writers. It doesn't matter what level they are. Do not feel threatened by other writers, because they are your friends. They are the people who are in the same boat as you. And to be honest, they might be just as threatened of you as you are of them, okay? Actually, when you can cross that line and when you can communicate with them on that level, you're going to open up an entirely new world, which is going to change writing for you forever.
Yeah.
And when it comes to publishing, it's very scary. If you don't have an agent, especially, and you know, we're not just talking about publishing houses. Be careful with agent contracts as well. If this is the first time you've done it, if you have no experience, if you have no legal counsel, then the best thing you can do is get in touch with other people who have the experience, who can talk you through it. And don't worry about a time limit. Don't feel, okay, hold on a second, though. If I don't get back to them within 24 hours, they're going to take away the contract. Because then you've got to ask yourself, if they take away the contract after 24 hours of not replying, of you not replying to them, then did you really want to be in a contract with those people? They should only really be contacting you if they actually want your book, and they want your book because they think it's an investment. Now, if you take several months to reply, that would probably be something else. But don't feel frightened of turning around to a publisher, even if they are your dream publisher, and saying, thank you for producing, for giving me this contract. I'm going to take some time to look through it. And don't be afraid to turn around and say, okay, I'd like these changes to be made to the contract.
You might not get everything you want. For example, if you say, and yes, this book is suitable for film and the writer will write the screenplay, that's actually quite a big ask on a contract. And you probably won't get that. But if you say things like, I would like this clause struck out, so I do not want to honour the right of first refusal. I'm willing to sign a two-book contract with you, but I do not want you to have first dibs on everything else I write forevermore afterwards. Because it's a trap in a lot of cases. That's the sort of thing you want struck out. You have to remember that the publisher is a business. They're going to do what's best for them to make money for their business. And you can't blame them for that. And in a way, you want them to be like that because it means that they want to sell your book. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be looking after your own interests. Because you should.
Yeah.
Don't trust the publisher to do it for you. That's not to say don't trust publishers, just don't expect them to put you particularly first.
That being said, most publishers want to keep their authors happy. So we're not trying to scare you away from going down the traditional publishing route, not in the least.
No, absolutely not.
We're just saying that as you go into there, go into it with confidence and remember your own worth. That's not to say be arrogant, because actually if you approach a publisher with arrogance saying, look at my work, it's the bee's knees, they probably won't want to touch you, simply because you have to remember that publishers are run by human beings as well. You know, it's not some giant machine corporation, just like reviewers reviewing books. Those books weren't written by a machine. The publishers aren't a machine. We're all people. And so you need to treat people like people. Oddly enough, revolutionary idea.
It's all part of being the best version of yourself you possibly can be in a professional context. And yeah, we're not trying to put you off going through a traditional publisher. There are lots of people who have very, very positive experiences like that or gain a lot from it. And I'd actually recommend, you know, trying both. Try self-publishing, try traditional. You will get something out of each experience, I think. But I would just say, you know, don't be so keen to sign that you end up really regretting it later.
Protect your interests and remember that you are the producer of the work. Now, when we say that, is that the book is not actually the thing ultimately that most publishers are going to be investing in, because when the book is done, that's it, you know, it's finished, they can sell it off. But you are the thing that has created that, and that book is not the only thing that you can create. You have established already that you are capable of making something that big. That means you can do it again. So also don't feel like this one book that you're trying to get published is going to be the be all and the end all, because it isn't. You've got plenty of other stuff in you.
Check out forums like Absolute Write and also Writer Beware, run by people with plenty of experience of all aspects of publishing as well. And also you might consider joining something like the Society of Authors over here in the UK, or there's an Australian counterpart, a Canadian counterpart, an American counterpart. Just a short Google search will find you who you should be speaking to. And quite often they, for a small fee paid annually, you can join them and they will have a legal department that will look through your contract for you, usually quite quickly.
Yeah. So yeah, you're not alone.
You're not alone.
First rule of writing, you're not alone.
But that's the point where you choose Hallows and not Horcruxes, if you know Harry Potter. So, yeah.
Oh, nice way of rounding it off.
I thought so. And we have pretty much run out of time on this one. But yes.
Big topic.
To cap it off, obviously, a fair bit of the author goes into every book if they're writing with emotional honesty, and those are the books that are really worth reading.
Yeah.
We've looked at rejections, we've looked at critique, and we've also looked at reviews and how to handle all three, hopefully.
And basically we've just given you a handbook of how to prepare your book for how to prepare your very own Horcrux.
Yes,
so there
things,
you go.
Things to watch out for.
And on that note, we will say goodbye.
We will.
We'll catch up with you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.